Welcome to the Common Geeking Program, a book club podcast where each week three of us read on a topic and discuss it from a geeky, nerdy perspective. This week, I am your host, Keenan Korish, and we will be discussing Avatar The Last Airbender, the extended universe. So we're going to be talking about Avatar The Last Airbender, the original series, and then a little bit probably about Avatar The Legend of Korra. And then in particular, I asked our representatives to read Avatar The Search, which is a comic set after the series. I am joined by two people, each of whom have selected a domain they think connects to our topic and theme this week. They are...
Hello, my name is Colin Ketchin, and on the topic of extended universes, I am representing the eclectic and fascinating Cloverfield franchise.
Hello, I'm Taimal Chaudhry, or Chatter, whichever you prefer. And I will be talking about the Kingdom Hearts series, which is going to be...
It's going to be exciting, guys. We got two people here talking about
given
things.
Given our group's affinity for bigger franchises like Star Trek and Star Wars and Marvel and comics, look at the three fucking things we picked to discuss extended universes. I feel like this podcast would be better in the hands of greater minds.
I originally wanted to do Star Wars, but we had just did a Star Wars episode, and I couldn't do a Star Wars episode.
That's true.
It was kind of a bummer because like this was like what I was gonna go into. So like I had to scramble, but then I remembered Avatar, and then it was all okay.
Mm.
Yeah, like I was about to talk about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, then like. Some trailers and gameplay dropped for Kingdom Hearts 3, and I knew I just wanted to talk about Kingdom Hearts.
See, I kind of had a similar problem to Keenan, where Keenan said extended universes. I'm like, well, Star Trek. Like, there's no question, Star Trek. Especially Disco just wrapped this past week, Star Trek Discovery, and I could have totally talked about that. But then, like, 2 days after he said,
wait, back up. Are you saying that, like, the shorthand for that is Star Trek Disco?
Well, okay, so the
that sounds a much better and more interesting show. Captain, the roof. The roof is on fire.
They have t-shirts that say D-I-S-C-O.
Midnight creeps so slowly.
It's the first letters in Discovery, so that's just what it is. Which makes me wonder why the original series, they didn't have t-shirts for the Enterprise called Star Trek Enter, but that also sounds vaguely pornographic.
Keep calm and, you know, boogie on. Live long and boogie on.
Okay, wait for it.
I like it. We're going to start the hour by summarizing our topic and domains before we openly discuss. Finally, we close with a competitive rating section to determine who contributed best and whether my topic is enjoyable. The topic being, of course, Avatar The Last Airbender. First, let's talk about Avatar The Last Airbender. The world is set in a world that is divided into four nations. The Water Tribe, the Earth Kingdom, the Fire Nation, and the Air Nobads.
Nobads?
That is 100% correct. Don't try to correct me, motherfuckers.
Keenan, I have a question.
What?
When did everything change?
Good question. When the Fire Nation attacked.
Okay, thank you. That was important.
Everything changed when the Fire Nation attacked.
Only the Avatar, master of all four elements, could stop them. But when the world needed him most... He vanished. 100 years passed.
Basically, each
an airbender named Aang.
There are these people called benders in the sea.
He has a lot to learn.
The Water Tribe is waterbenders.
But I believe Aang can save the world.
And there's earthbenders, firebenders in the Fire Nation, and airbenders in the air nomads, which are like, the air nomads are weird. They're not like really nations. They're like four city states, basically. So I don't let that confuse you.
Yeah.
They're also gone. The Fire Nation decided to conquer the world, and they're technologically more advanced. Like, they use coal ships. They have, like, tanks and stuff. They're, like, it's a very interesting, you know, world.
Sound like a bunch of steampunks.
Or, you know, the Industrial Revolution.
And the Avatar, who is the master of all four elements and has the only one in the world who has the ability to bend more than one kind of element.
He is also the bridge between the spirit and material world.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, he's also supposed to be this bridge of understanding between all man, because he, like, you know, he has a little bit, he knows a bunch about everybody. You know, he's a waterbender with waterbenders, you know.
Given all the intrigue in the show, you could call him a suspension bridge.
Nyak, 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 nyak.
Yeah, right? But he disappeared 100 years ago. So this war between the Fire Nation and everyone else has been going on for 100 years. And then one day, he shows up in this block of ice, and he's a 12-year-old airbender. Now, he's found by these two kids, Katara and Sokka, from the Southern Water Tribe, and they find the long-lost Avatar. So the first series is all about how the Avatar learning how to bend all the elements and then trying to achieve his destiny of bringing balance to the world by ending the war. Now, along the way...
Now, I think we should say for listeners, just to preserve our own credibility, we are speaking, of course, of the Nickelodeon cartoon series and not the phenomenally well-reviewed film from 2010 starring Noah Ringer.
You better watch your fucking mouth. Like, you better bleep that shit out, all right?
Curse you.
Ignore the movie.
We will not speak his name.
I think I might actually bleep out every time we say... So drop his name a lot in here, so I have a lot of things to bleep out.
Yeah.
Initially,
our primary antagonist is this prince from the Fire Nation, exiled prince named Zuko, and then we pick up another friend who's an earthbender, and her name is Toph. And eventually, we pick up a lot of friends, and we like just make this like really cool team. And this show really hit well with a lot of people for their cultural references, as well as having like. Magic that isn't based because it is kind of magic, a sort of spiritual world that isn't based on Western mythology.
It's more based in spirituality than trying to be fantastical when it comes to the application of magic.
Western depictions of magic revolve around like literacy, words and stuff. Avatar is all based around motion and like movement.
The thing is about Avatar is that it also gave a very realistic depiction of war, like wartime and nationalism, and it had a lot of really adult mature themes, you know, about honor, family, you know, ties, all sorts of stuff like that. And just
there's a lot of parallels between the Fire Nation and World War II era Japan. A lot of parallels between Ba Sing Se and China, so on and so forth. You know,
I've watched all of The Last Airbender. I read the comic The Search that you want us to read. I've only seen the first season of Korra, but I am curious, because I haven't invested a ton, how these extra things expand on Last Airbender in a meaningful way. Because I've never thought of this as an expanded universe until you pitched it.
For one, when Colin said Legend of Korra, there was a sequel series. It's set 70 years after the events of the first Avatar ends.
And we pick up with the new Avatar, the reincarnation of Aang, Korra.
I'm the Avatar! You gotta deal with it!
Yeah, because the Avatar is a reincarnated being. There's only ever one.
At a time.
And that one's about Korra, who's the next Avatar. She's from the Southern Water Tribe, unlike Aang in the first one, who was an airbender. Hence the name Avatar the Last Airbender. Korra actually is very different, since it being 70 years after, there's a lot of different stuff.
Technology in the Avatar universe advanced in those 70 years, so it's like in the equivalent of the Roaring Twenties in the Avatarverse.
And Korra has already mastered water, fire, and earth, and she's just trying to learn air, and she's in Republic City, which is like this great melting pot of the 1920s where everyone kind of lives together, but there's like some tension between benders and non-benders, and that's where we start off with her actually learning from Aang's son Tenzin how to be an airbender. And then finally, I had them read Avatar the Last Airbender The Search, which is
Don't get me wrong, this comic takes place immediately after The Last Airbender series.
Well, not immediately. There's actually...
Because they're drawn the same way.
Yeah, no, they are drawn the same way. They're made by the same people.
There's like a couple of comics between the series and The Search, you know? Like.
Okay.
And it's canon.
Okay.
It's set a little bit after a other comic, which is Avatar The Last Airbender The Rift.
Yeah.
Generally, not immediately after the series of Avatar The Last Airbender.
Pretty close to it.
And for those of you who don't know, The Search revolves around the mystery following Zuko, the exiled prince, who actually eventually becomes our friend and starts off as our primary antagonist and has one of the best character arcs I've ever seen in fiction ever.
The best redemption arc in history.
Because he just goes from being like a terrible person that I hate to being this like actually really sympathetic, beautiful character that is stained by tragedy, and you actually want to like be a good guy again. And there's a few times before he goes fully good guy. Spoiler alert, because we're talking about an extended universe, we may end up spoiling a bunch of stuff. So just letting people know, like, kind of
don't worry. We'll sound the spoiler alert.
So it kind of revolves around him and the fact that you never really knew about his mother, Ursa, who was this, like, who was the queen of the Fire Nation. And there's a bunch of mystery around why she disappeared before the start of the series. And that's just, it was just a question that was never answered in the series. And it was finally answered in comic form.
I didn't realize it was asked in the series. I guess I just totally forgot about that.
Well, so it was poised in the series. Like, you know something happened.
Okay.
But you don't know what happened.
Oh, and all right. I thought that this was just, like, out of the blue. Like, the writers saw an opportunity to fill something in, and they did. Not they were answering a question they had asked earlier.
No, no. Like, last episode of Avatar, The Last Airbender, there's, like, a moment where Zuko's like, "Where's my mother?" And then it cuts.
And we're like, oh.
And we never got an answer. We never got
a tease. Was that when he was fighting Fire Lord Ozai?
That was at the end when Ozai was already defeated. Okay, and he went to visit him. He was like, all right, I'm going to figure this out.
Well, the quick, like, 2-minute synopsis of the point of this, the search, is, well, 2 sentences, I should say. His mother was in love with a dude back home, but then was asked to marry Ozai. The relationship turned sour, and she...
And by sour, immediately abusive.
Abusive, yeah, abusive and terrible.
And rapey.
Super rapey for a kid's story. She then solicited the service of a... of the Mother of Faces, a spirit, to change her identity and erase her memory so she could live happily with the person she truly loved. And Zuko and his sister Azula find this out. And then the Mother of Faces restores the memory to her, and they have a nice reconciliatory moment that addresses both Zuko's abandonment issues and Azula's very intense mania and hallucination, borderline schizophrenia towards her mother.
Yep.
The reason why I chose this series is because this is such a beloved series, and it's rare that any sort of show spawns more than one series. Like, it's not just another season. It's like a whole nother series, and then that spawned a comic that wasn't just a adaption of the series or an adaption of, like, a movie or a TV show. It was actually a continuation of another story set within the world, sometimes with the characters, other times, you know, with other people.
The inclusion of the spirit, the Mother of Faces, seemed like the biggest addition to this world. Was she new in this comic, or did she come from somewhere else?
Yeah, she's new in this comic.
Okay.
But she is related to a character we see in the first season.
A spirit, yeah.
Ko, the face stealer.
Yeah, I had a note about that, because I watched the series properly years ago, so I do not recall what it is. But I had a note about who Ko, the face stealer, is, because the comic was like, oh, yeah, that guy. And I'm like, take me along for the ride. I don't know what's happening. You are leaving me behind, friends.
Ko is this creepy spirit that steals faces. He's kind of like a chaotic, he's like a neutral type. Yeah. Like, he just kind of does what he wants.
That's
he's
fair.
Vaguely menacing. No, sorry, he's super menacing.
And, like, the thing about Ko is he was like a one-scene wonder. We saw him once. He hints that, like, we'll meet again, Avatar.
And then they don't.
He never comes back.
Fantastic world-building Nickelodeon.
Now let's move on to our domains, where I'm going to let our representatives summarize what they brought to the table and kind of see what they're dealing with and why they did that. So let's start once again with Colin.
Oh, hey. So, for a very long time, I have been a fan of Mr. J.J. Abrams. This was before he got his paws on Star Trek, and actually, I like the things he's done with Star Trek. But alongside the production of Star Trek came a little movie called Cloverfield in 2008. And this movie has gone from an interesting film to something that's fairly enigmatic. Because Cloverfield, 2008, directed by Matthew Reeves, was a film, a found footage horror kaiju thriller set in Manhattan.
Did you guys just see that?
So these folks are undergoing a monster attack, but it's all shot from, like, a camcorder. So it's very hard to tell what's going on. It's like boots on the ground perspective, people who don't know what's happening just trying to survive. Some people took issue with the film because they got, like, motion sickness or felt that the shaky camera was jarring. I enjoyed it a lot, and it's gotten fairly positive reviews, and everyone was wondering, when are you going to make a sequel to this? And they were like, we're going to do it! And then it didn't happen.
Until...
January of 2016, unless you were paying very close attention to Hollywood news, a surprise trailer came out for a movie called 10 Cloverfield Lane, directed by Dan Trachtenberg. It released March 2016, and this film is not found footage. You do not see a gigantic monster, unless you count John Goodman.
Something's coming.
So whoa. The film... I love John Goodman, and his performance was spectacular. There are five actors in that movie, and they knock it out of the park. It was originally a script called The Cellar, which is just a small movie that Paramount was going to produce, and then JJ was like, let me get a look at that script. Let me see what you got going on
there. It's my script now.
Yeah, basically, and he's just like eating up little scripts and turning them into movies because The Cellar had nothing to do with Cloverfield, and then they thought, this... It doesn't look the same, it doesn't sound the same, but it's got some of those same core vibes, the fear, the uncertainty, the darkness, and the kind of goofy witticisms of the characters in tight interactions. So they named it 10 Cloverfield Lane, and it was intended to be that, but the actors didn't find out until a couple days before the trailer came out. Mary Elizabeth Winstead was on the phone with J.J. Abrams, and he was like, I want you to be in a franchise film. Actually, you're already in a franchise film. And actually, the trailer's coming out soon. It's called 10 Cloverfield Lane. Have fun.
Wait, that does seem kind of dirty, because
he's not...
Actors mm-hmm. who have the possibility of being a franchise thing can use that as a bargaining chip.
Leverage.
Yep. In negotiating pay and stuff. So it's kind of a dick move.
You've got to kind of balance that against how to cleverly market a film. And the marketing of Cloverfield, I think, plays a big part in it, because just recently, again, unless you're paying very close attention to the news... a movie came out called The Cloverfield Paradox on Netflix.
The Earth. It's gone.
It's big, blue, full of angry people. Keep looking, you'll find it.
My God.
During the Super Bowl of 2018, they released a trailer saying, hey, Cloverfield, you want to know what happened? There's a movie coming out in, like, literally 2 hours on Netflix.
By the way.
And everyone was like, what the hell? Where did this come from? 10 Cloverfield Lane was excellent. Best reviewed of the three. The Cloverfield Paradox. Not as good. Not as well reviewed. Basically, now, I enjoyed the movie a lot. I watched it immediately. I had a lot of fun, but it's definitely flawed and is not quite as tight conceptually. But instead of being set in, like, this bunker, like 10 Cloverfield Lane, it's set in a space station. It's based on a script called The God Particle, where again they ate up the script. They didn't change this into a Cloverfield movie until it was already filming, unlike 10 Cloverfield, where they changed it in pre-production.
What the shit?
So some stuff kind of didn't get tied up super well. The thing is, all three of these movies, the third one tries to explain vaguely how all this madness, how these monsters and how these terrible alien situations came into play, but really it's very open. And J.J. Abrams' famous push to incorporate the mystery box into everything as a concept
mystery box.
I'll explain more about it in the discussion, but the movies are tied together not by actors, except one connection, or narrative, but simply by theme. And Dan Trachtenberg has called it the Cloververse. And we're getting another one later this year called Overlord, a World War II Nazi zombie film. And it is only going to get crazier from here, and I'm fascinated at how they are building this ridiculous world.
All right, that was a great introduction to something I know very little about. I personally hate found footage. I think it's tacky. Anyway. Going on to the next one. Chowder, what have you got? Let's make this simple. I know it's not, but like, let's try.
Let's make this simple and clean.
That was not clean. Sorry, that was a gross burp.
Anyways, so I'm talking about Kingdom Hearts. Kingdom Hearts is a series of video games made by Square Enix. It is a Disney Final Fantasy crossover. Already this entire thing jumps off the goddamn cliff. Okay, I need you to understand, we're talking about a franchise where Sephiroth fights Goofy.
Alright, sounds... that tracks.
Goofy, the famous Disney dog character of
a is
Goofy
he a dog,
movie.
Though? Like, I never figured that
he's
out.
He's a dog. Yes, he's a dog.
But, like,
don't ask
Pluto's
a dog, don't ask
a though.
Pluto question, we're not getting into that. Anyway, go ahead.
All right, so they're action RPGs. Each the plot of the game, or the plot the quick and dirty of these the series is. It follows
quick and dirty.
This character named Soraz has to fend off a variety of enemies such as Heartlesses and Nobodies with the help of Donald and Goofy as he goes from world to world, these worlds being based on like different Disney properties and different Final Fantasy properties. He is the wielder of something called the Keyblade, which is this magical key-shaped sword that is important in like stopping the Heartless and opening Kingdom Hearts. If I go into any more detail, I am going to run into the ridiculous-ass plot of fucking Kingdom Hearts, because this gets convoluted very quickly.
Putting aside the plot, how do they build out the world? Because it's all, like, established IP that they're just chunking together.
Quick backstory that is addressed in, like, Birth by Sleep. Basically, there was a
whatever
big,
that is.
It is one of the games in the series. Nobody knows what the fuck Birth by Sleep means. Anyways, there was once this big war that, and people were fighting over this thing called the Kingdom Hearts.
2 minutes.
I have 2 minutes left.
You have 2 minutes left.
Oh, damn. Okay.
Yeah. So, oh, jump to the world.
See what I meant? Oh. I told you!
Okay. They were fighting over this thing called the Kingdom Hearts. The war got bad. Everything broke. Then, like, people fixed it. But, like, when they fixed it, it split everything into these different worlds. And that's how this functions. These are worlds that are kind of independent from each other, but do share a universe.
So almost like planes in like D&D and shit like that, how you're supposed to have these separate realms that all connect and overlap?
Yeah, it's not unlike that. So yeah, that's not a bad analogy. All right, so the reason I'm talking about Kingdom Hearts is, not including some mobile stuff and whatever, there are 7 games in this series. You want to know what the upcoming game is called?
Kingdom Hearts 8?
Kingdom Hearts 3! Kingdom Hearts. There are 2 mainline Kingdom Hearts game, 5 like side stories, except the side stories, or if you just play 1 and 2, there are big questions. You don't know what the fuck is going on. You need to know those 5 side stories. But like, they're not like all on a single console or like in a single line of consoles. They're not all on the PlayStation line. They're on like the Game Boy Advance, the PSP, the 3DS.
It's like Square Enix is trying to create the ultimate scavenger hunt.
And like the way it's all written, it's like Kingdom Hearts is Kingdom Hearts like keeps adding to the story, but like every time they try to answer their questions, they just create more questions. I love this game. I love this stupid beautiful game, but oh my god.
That was such a dramatic ending.
Sounds ridiculous.
And you say you hate the mystery box. Bullshit.
All right, everyone. Where was I? Now that we summarized everything, let's discuss a little bit.
All right, there we go. Cool.
Now, I was wondering, guys, now, we all have very varied worlds, and I was just wondering, guys, that not every franchise, every series, gets picked up for, like, another series, and then comics and stuff. They don't all do this.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what about
Star Trek,
the series that you guys have brought, makes it a world that's, you know, able? Do you think it's a matter of being able to be expanded? Or is it sometimes just like the world's really cool? Like, what about some series allows them?
I'm going to let Chowder go first, because my answer is going to be much simpler than his.
Because right, JJ Abrams really wanted to do one.
We'll get around to it. It's so, slightly more nuanced, not much.
What makes Kingdom Hearts world so worth coming back to is the characters, like how it can be so emotional in the moment, because like as convoluted as the plot gets, the twisted turns it takes to get to where it is does genuinely good act 1 minute.
Mm-hmm.
I can't come. I'm where are you going? Like, maybe I can drive there when I'm done.
I've paused time. This is not going to take up time, don't worry.
No, it has
not
to.
Not sure. Like,
Keenan, no.
Doing something right now.
Keenan, please.
We will stick to the plan.
Keenan, no. We must abort.
All
right, Chatter, go ahead.
Okay, so, for example, the characters of Namine and Roxas. They are these things called nobodies, which are like empty shells of people who have had their hearts taken away from them.
Their kingdom hearts?
Whoa, kingdom shit. right, it's all coming together.
Whoa! The world is expanded!
Kingdom Hearts is where all the hearts go to when people die. Anyways.
Oh, it's heaven. They could just call it heaven with a racist mouse.
Wouldn't it have been easier? Anyways. So, like, it's like this convoluted explanation on how they came to be, because they're, like, nobodies of, like, two important characters, Sora and Kairi, and while it takes all these twists to get to that point, when you actually, like, get to them, they have these compelling stories. Like, Roxas has this tragic story about, like, making friends with this guy named Axel and this girl named Xion, only to, like, lose it all and then, like, end up in this dream world where, you know, he's, like, living out this normal life without any of this Organization 13 bullshit. But then turns out it's all fake and he has to, like, basically sacrifice his life to give it back to Sora. And he's so reluctant about it. And there's this melancholic feel to it. And it's sad. So.
Well, I mean, like, that kind of answers the question of what ropes you into that story and that plot.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is,
like, that's not the only reason. The other reason is because the concept of Final Fantasy crossing over with Disney is so novel, because, like, they're
so,
like,
even aside from, like, thematic and stylistic stuff, sheerly just, like, the gameplay of having this mishmash is fun enough to sustain it, and all this extra story is just bonus, basically.
That's true, yeah. Because you're a video game and you get to have that benefit.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, okay. Yeah, like, the ultimate point I want to make about Kingdom Hearts is that...
Ultimate, right at the beginning.
All the expanding of the universe...
Just like our universe.
Making things interconnected and whatnot, it's ultimately unimportant in comparison to, like, things like style and characters, and that's what the audience comes back for. And, like, if you don't have that, it's just not a universe worth coming back to.
Well, to compare your answer to mine, I can give you two quick reasons Cloverfield is marching forward. One, J.J. Abrams has money. Two, good marketing. And that's right. A lot of what it boils down to. Cloverfield's marketing, I will honestly say, is a big part of why I enjoy them. For all the problems that the concept of the mystery box, which is, you know, like, don't answer all the audience questions, keep them coming back and asking questions for more. There are some issues with that from a story standpoint when you're trying to create full worlds. If J.R.R. Tolkien said during, you know, the creation of Lord of the Rings, I'm just not going to explain where Sauron came from, I think there would be some holes in that story. But when it comes to these movies, it feels kind of like they are thought out and they're just holding back information.
Okay.
And the way that these marketing campaigns work is, back to the original Cloverfield, it was just like people in New York and then suddenly shit starts exploding and there's like a tagline that's intriguing. And the trailer doesn't tell you a lot, and it got people in the theater. But that had a $25 million budget and made $171 back and got good reviews.
And then, like, once you get the answer, it's a giant monster. It's exactly what you expect.
It is exactly what you'd expect. In terms of, hey, it's a monster, and then it's a monster, sure. You get that it's a monster pretty early. Some people didn't know that going in.
But who's the real monster?
John Goodman.
Something's coming.
So yeah. I, in watching the original Cloverfield, I was very satisfied with the ending, not because it had this whole perfectly buttoned up narrative. It had a nice character arc, and the characters are what propelled the movie. But I found something really interesting in all three of these movies, that you can connect to a person in an experience and then experience the same lack of understanding and resolution. The movie ends with those characters dying.
Spoiler alert!
So if they don't get to know the end, maybe I don't have to know the end either. So it's interesting.
Spoiler alert.
And I think all the movies do that in a way that I wouldn't expect. And the power of Cloverfield, and the reason that they're finally building this out and it's actually working, is because there is something to the mystery box that makes sense. They're building a universe by not answering all the questions, and it's ass backwards and it's fascinating.
Yeah. The thing with Kingdom Hearts is, like, it'll have all these questions, then it'll answer them, but only to create more questions. And, like,
That would definitely be a common theme between our choices versus Avatar, The Last Airbender.
Yeah, and it's...
Yeah, I think it's interesting that Avatar The Last Airbender largely answers all the questions. The other ones are more thing. The questions that were left unanswered, like what happened to Zuko's mother, are mostly like really fan driven. Like, fans really wanted to know that. Like, the smaller things, like, what about this guy? You know, what happened to this character? What about this place? You know, like, for me, like, I still haven't, like, figured out what happened to Suki. Like, what happened to Sokka's, you know, OTP, you know, that just, she just was never mentioned again in the second series, and I always wondered. But, when it
neither was Sokka, aside from, like, a brief moment.
Sokka was mentioned, but,
as a judge, but...
Yeah, the point is, I think it's interesting that you guys, like, said, well, it's because, you know, people keep coming back because they want to know more, and, like... I think that is also true of Avatar, but in a different way. I think what Avatar did is they made such a, one, visually, a gorgeous world, and then also it's such an attractive world because it's, it's so lifelike, despite being like, I was going to say that, like, it's not like high fantasy, but it does have some fantastical elements. But it's such a complete and full world that I think people really feel like they want to know more about it. And then you only get a taste because you only follow, you know, like for the most part, four characters as they briefly stop in some towns along the way. And there's just so much more that you hear about and you know about. You want to know so much more about this world because it really pulls you in with how believable and, I don't want to say like honest, but genuine, you know?
What interests me most about Avatar is, as it relates to expanded universes, is not the search, which is a great story, but like, when it comes to expanded universes, what's more interesting, I think, is are the stories The Rift and Smoke and Shadow, because they tell very different stories from what Avatar The Last Airbender was. You know, Avatar The Last Airbender, if you boil it down to its core, it's basically overthrow the evil overlord. Basically, The Rift and Smoke and Shadow are about the aftermath of what happens when you end a 100-year war. Well, now that you've ended it, you have to A, get the people to not want get the Fire Nation people to not want another one, figure out what to do with all the places that the Earth Nation are the Fire Nation has colonized. You have to figure out what to do with the people. There are all these logistical things that most stories don't talk about because, you know, it would kill the buzz. And like Avatar has this opportunity to now address that story.
There's an interesting conflict to me on either a conceptual or a thematic basis with Avatar in that it's definitely a kid's show and it's definitely a kid's IP. It's meant for children to enjoy and it handles a lot of complex stuff as well. I think where it clashes for me, specifically in this comic, The Search, when in the third part of it, the Mother of Faces is explaining, like, I craft all the faces in the world, and people want to change their faces, and it insults me. They're very good at threading personal narratives through this world, and I think those personal narratives with Avatar in particular paint it. But, like, the concept of faces as an element, and then the switching to and from Ursa to her alternate identity of Noriko, a lot of that felt super elementary, and that's something that I didn't feel a whole lot in the show. I felt like the show never backed away from being very mature. And this definitely had some mature themes. But I'm wondering if conceptually there's a limit to how adult you can be when trying to keep it simple for kids to grasp.
Yeah.
And I think that might inhibit it. This is the first time in anything with Avatar that I've felt like this doesn't feel like it's growing the world in a meaningful way.
I feel they expand upon it a bit more in Smoke and Shadow, where, you know, Ursa comes back to the Fire Nation. And, you know, we see all the after effects of the Fire Lord on her. You know, it's a lot of PTSD and stuff. And that's cool. They definitely address it.
I think you can't really fault the mythology of the world for being too simple, because mythology usually is.
Yeah.
And I think what they've done, though, is they've walked that line between really simple,
that's fair,
child, you know, being made for a child, and also these much deeper meanings, really, like, remarkably well. Like, it won a Peabody Award, which is this award given for, like, it's like a humanitarian award.
A writing,
given
yeah.
to... Yeah. Of to television, radio, and other media, like not movies, because that's it's like not the Golden Globes or not the Oscars, but it's like it won for its depiction of like war and nationalism and all these other things, because it does a remarkable job of still being for kids. Yet there are times where I've like watched episodes like as an adult and be like, how is this ever for children? How was I able to absorb this?
So, like, with the...
Ooh, I'm going to circle back to that. Go ahead, Chatter.
I think The Rift and Smoke and Shadow relate to what you say, because, like, you know, they're talking, like, the main point of those stories is, like, what do we do about all the Fire Nation people or, like, mixed race people living in these Earth colonies? And like, that is such a adult theme that can often feel dry and boring. But, like, Avatar is able to, like, address that very skillfully. That is not a story you get to see often because, you know, it's a lot more exciting to overthrow the authority rather than dealing with the fallout of the revolution, doing all the busy work and the paperwork and the politics. So
I have a point I'm very excited to make on this topic.
Yeah, and the fact that Avatar has strong enough characters that they feel they can carry it through using those characters is a testament.
Something that fascinates me about kind of the stuff that just we discussed is, you know, how this is built for kids, and a kid can't possibly understand all that allegory. Thinking again about how what I like about Cloverfield is not just the films themselves, but how they're presented to us. I'm wondering if we, again, look outside of the show of Avatar and the comics, think of it like we saw it as kids. And then there are, you know, adults today who saw Star Wars as kids. But, like, we saw it as kids, and, like, revisiting it as adults, we can find so much more in it. And that is actually that's an excellent staple of, I think, maybe a world that's fully realized. Yeah. Something that can appeal to the simplest parts of us. And through good character, I think Avatar really does that. But then there's something for you nerds to sit and obsess about for a long time.
Yeah, like, Kingdom Hearts is a lot like that, too, you know, because, like, most people who started playing Kingdom Hearts were usually, like, in their teens, or mostly in their teens, some of them in childhood. But, you know, when you're a teenager, you know, you're getting all this, like, very high up there metaphorical stuff about having equal parts light and darkness within your hearts and all this kind of stuff. And, like, it sounds, like, big and epic, and it's kind of hard to understand when you're a kid, but as you get older, you kind of come to understand what they're talking about. And also, like, the main character of Sora kind of has this changing feeling as you get older. You know, when you're a kid, he's just like you. He's upbeat, he's a kid just like you. But, like, when you're an adult, you get this kind of parental affection for Sora. He's like, so
I'm so proud of you, Sora. You graduated from Kingdom Hearts to high, going to college.
It's kind of cool to look at, like, the ability to return to a franchise at a different age as a mark of how well its world is built.
Yeah.
And I just like the idea that some of these things can, like, transcend nostalgia. Like, we can all go back to things we liked as a kid. Like, I can go back to Sonic the Hedgehog as an adult, but I'm not playing Sonic the Hedgehog going, this has such a deeper meaning to me now. Unlike Star Trek. Star Trek as a kid, I was like, duh, there's big ships. And now I'm like, this is telling me how to live my life. And there's actually one point about Star Trek I do want to make, and I think this ties to Cloverfield and Avatar, and honestly, Chowder's description of Kingdom Hearts. There's an argument that's been made that Star Trek is not a series, it is not a movie, it is not a story. Star Trek is a place. It is a place where stories can live, and you can do just about anything in there. And I feel like Cloverfield, and what J.J. Abrams has said is his amusement park approach to this, where Cloverfield is an amusement park and each movie is a different ride. It's, like, interesting to have these worlds bound by theme, and you can do anything in them. And that to me, reading this comic, despite my misgivings, and seeing Korra, it feels much the same way. Avatar is kind of a place.
Yeah, I agree.
Lord of the Rings is much as the same way. Like, you can tell a story about...
fucking love Tolkien.
You can tell a story about just about anything. A random soldier in a far-off fight. Something that preceded the events of Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit. It's just a big enough world to inhabit all these different stories.
You know, if we're trying to, like, dissect the Fire Nation, no one's gonna get really angry at us because they're from the Fire Nation, and the Fire Nation would never do that, because we kind of get to objectively kind of think about these things. And since it's fantastical, we can kind of, like, allow ourselves to, you know, think about it, because it's not real. We don't have to get scared by it. So I think it's better when we're taught these kind of things in fictional universes. I super liked what you guys said about complexity. I think that's a big marker of whether a world is able or, frankly, should be expanded, is if you go back and it still has this complexity that, not, like, convoluted.
Like Kingdom Hearts.
No, like all these other aspects.
Yeah,
and,
like, nobody's looking for the Yo Gabba Gabba extended universe.
Yeah.
But maybe we should.
Just, like, you can go back and you can look more. It still has stuff to offer. Like you said, without the lens of nostalgia.
Yeah.
And I hope that, like, Kingdom Hearts is a bit older now, but I hope, like, Cloverfield and all their other movies, I hope, like, 20 years from now, Colin, if you're, like, watching them, you can still say, oh, wow, I never noticed that about about that character. And that's about it for our discussion. I think we did really well. Thank you both.
So, Keenan, we're starting to do something. We're soliciting user questions from listeners of the podcast or just people who stalk us on Facebook.
Create our content.
Please give us free content ideas. We love it. So once a week, I'll try to post something on our Facebook or Twitter at Geeking Program about an upcoming topic, and you can leave questions, and we're going to do those on the show. We actually got a question from a user, and I would like to ask this to you, Keenan. We have two questions, but the first one, listener named Jonas Hassan, how did lightning benders get so numerous in The Legend of Korra?
Well, Mr. Hassan, one, awesome sounding name, Jonas Hassan. You sound like a detective in a noir name.
Better than
You better bleep that out. The reason why lightning benders are so popular, while there are so many and numerous in Legend of Korra, is, well, one, when we first are introduced to lightning benders, it's mainly through Azula, and then Iroh talks about how he also, you know, knows about that stuff, and in fact, he's an OG at it and, like, does it. But that's, you have to remember, that's 70 years, and then 70 years later, they're really numerous. And the Roaring Twenties, I think it's also in, like, kind of talking to, as Chowder hinted on, that the themes of the Roaring Twenties was when a lot of technology advanced. And it advanced, not only did it advance very rapidly, the technology itself.
Yeah, like, so it was just basically growth of culture and technology and experience. It made it more accessible to people.
Oh, yeah, it was basically just time and how it was able to be taught. It's kind of like how metal bending is also just as, you know, popular. Yeah,
basically, once some people figured it out, they start to spread to other people. And those people start to spread to other people. And it basically expanded exponentially. Before Legend of Korra, lightning bending was like a technique that was, you know, relegated to like the royal family, maybe a few like upper echelon people. But like once like the Industrial Revolution hits, it became far more useful for them to pass it on to others so that they could use it for Industrial Revolution related.
Like, it's still a skill, but you know, it's more people were able to have access to teaching.
Cool. So we have one other listener question. This one, its nature may be more dubious. But listener Patrick Brem asks, why wasn't Pat included in this episode?
Well, you see, Pat...
Because you called Avatar an anime, and I will not have that blasphemy here.
That's pretty true. You can't say that.
And during the shipping episode, he was talking about how he was all over Katara and Zuko. He's one of those guys.
Oh, also, yeah, like, that was, like, a cool idea, but I saw that more as, like, him becoming a little bit more human. Also, you said that, like, the best relationship, I think, in a previous episode, and maybe I'm misquoting you, was the Water Tribe princess and Sokka, and I was always on the Tsukisaka boat, and like, oh, while that was cute,
so,
like,
and, but it was so well represented in the fantastic on film.
Thank you both for a fantastic and enlightening discussion. Now we're going to do ratings. Begin by each representative giving a rate of Avatar: The Last Airbender on 1 to 5 cabbages.
Oh, my cabbages!
Which, if you know the series, is a running joke.
Are we rating Avatar or are we rating The Search?
I think we should be rating The Search because that's what we had to read for this.
Okay, so we'll rate The Search on 1 to 5 cabbages.
My cabbages!
So
there you go. Rate my cabbages.
Rate my cabbages. Swipe left on that guy's cabbages. So reading The Search, I definitely took some issue in the third part with some of the choices they made to develop the Mother of Faces as well as Ursa. That sort of robbed most of this thing of its own intelligence, and the themes of family, I thought, were not very subtly interwoven. It was kind of beaten over the head with it a bit. It was a very moving story, and there were a lot of very serious things that they tackled very well. So I enjoyed it, but I definitely had a bit of a sour taste by some of the stuff at the end. That might just be my own preference, and because of that, I am giving you a paltry 3 cabbages.
Not my cabbages!
Bring us 3 cabbages. All right. Good score.
Good cabbage. Shouted, good cabbage.
What card of cabbages do you have? Yo, rate it.
A cornucopia of cabbages. So, those won't fit in a cornucopia.
With Avatar The Search, I feel it helped to expand upon Zuko's character. I feel like it made Ursula a character that's more beyond just, maiden mother figure who was too pure for this world, and to like a real character with like her own struggles. It's the way it addresses like abuse and marriages, the way it really digs into the tragic stories of Zuko, his mother, and Azula, and the ultimate fates of these characters. I feel it did so well. I would genuinely give it 5 cabbages.
Nice.
Which I would then begin to smash just to piss off Cabbage
Sword. My cabbages! This place is worse than Umashu!
Funny.
Were there any cabbages in the film of the same name?
No. And it is all the more worse for it.
Probably not, but you better stop saying that name, man. I'm getting real sick of it.
I just want more reasons to bleep it. The audience will never know what name we're saying.
What a twist.
Okay, Robot Chicken.
Oh, thank you both. You know, next I will award a gold star student, giving a reward to the person who I think best brought a more introspective look at expanded universes.
That's fair.
So I will be awarding the Golden Boomerang.
Ooh.
Ah, yes. Sokka's boomerang?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
To Colin. That is mainly because I thought your look at the complexity and talking about absorption, you made some really good points. It was really tight there because I thought, Chowder, you also brought some really cool aspects of talking about how a video game is a little bit different as an expanded universe because gameplay is a thing. And I thought that was a cool thing. But I thought that, like, Colin just seemed to go a lot deeper, at least from what I saw.
Quick and dirty.
Talking about, like, the making of the game and also about some of the origins of each individual installment, and then talking about, like, the mystery box and talking about how, like, the themes are what connects it. And then he, like, talked even more about, like, the Avatar, which he frankly hasn't even, like, seen that much of, but was still able to, like, really identify and be very sympathetic with it.
Well, I've seen the whole show, and I've seen the first
season. Well, you haven't seen Korra, is what I'm saying.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, I haven't seen all of that.
And that is why I am giving Colin the Golden Boomerang.
I just want to say, Chowder, I am sorry for the sting of literally losing to the mystery box.
I mean, I just fucking hate the mystery box. It's mystery for only the sake of mystery without any payoff.
Oh, I also don't like that idea either.
But here I am enjoying the content generated by it. So while I appreciate that you get no benefit, I certainly do.
Yeah. You know what's in the mystery box, Colin?
What? What's in
this? This middle finger.
Oh, now it's out. The middle finger comes out and the podcast goes off the fucking rails.
Yeah.
That about wraps it up. Thank you for listening to the Common Geeking program. I'm your host, King Kosh, and I don't have a Twitter yet, but I really should. I'm hilarious, and also the next leader of the world. Again, I've been joined by...
My name is Colin. You can find me at SanaColinK on basically every platform.
I'm Taimal Chowdhury. You can find me at Taimal Chowdhury on Twitter. So
next week, we will have another episode. Crazy, right? Next week, and that will be hosted by...
Yeah, I'll be hosting the next episode. The topic is Kiki's Delivery Service, the famous Studio Ghibli film by Hayao Miyazaki. The theme is beauty in the mundane. Some media chooses to elevate what is considered the normal, the everyday, and it'll be a cool episode, hopefully.
Yeah. All right, March 16th. Be sure to listen to that episode next Friday, March 16th.
March 16th.
In the free time, feel free to follow us on Facebook or Twitter at Geeking Program. Any engagement, such as sharing a post, tagging us, or tweeting hashtag CGP, as well as hashtag Riot in Kentucky, will enter you into a raffle where you get to pick the topic for a future episode. You can also review us on Apple Podcasts, which is a critical way for new people to find the show. And we will read all new reviews on the air. Whatever you do, thank you for your support. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. You guys are the best.
What the fuck just happened?
Holy cow.
You want to say that?
Oh my god. Dude. That was the craziest audio rubber band I've ever heard. Keenan, you went silent for like 10 seconds, and that entire read went through in about half a goddamn second. Holy fuck.
It was like
fuck.
Demonic, man.
Good, because I added another hashtag.
Oh, no! I really hope you actually said hashtag CGP.
I did, but I also added another one.
Okay.
Oh, God.
I guess I'll find out in the edit.
This episode of the Common Geeking Program is hosted by Keenan Kodish, featuring Colin Ketchin and Taimul Chowder Chowdery. This episode is sponsored by Rate My Cabbages, the top-rated vegetable and plant life sexualization app now available on the Apple and Google Play stores. The podcast is created by Colin Ketchin and Jeff Levitt, with this episode edited by me, Colin Ketchin, featuring original music also by me. Next week, we have an episode Chowder is hosting about Kiki's delivery service, but before then, we're putting out something special. Chowder and I recorded him trying to explain to me the nuance of the Kingdom Hearts universe. It's a train wreck, and we hope you enjoy it. In the meantime, I just want to say thank you for listening to this.
Save that one for a surprise. That's one that I'm not really worried about, but I do want to hear your response to it in the moment. I want a hot take on that.
All right, cool.
I'm flexing my producer muscles right now.
I'm excited. Your producer muscles? You better not, like, ask me to come to some goddamn couch. I'm about to end up on a desk, okay, buddy? All right, you better not. You just better be a real job. There's a real modeling job, right? There's a real calendar job, right?
This is, huh? No, yeah. I'm gonna pass it up the line to my producers if they like what they see.
Show us how wild you get.
I think you've got a real future in this industry.
We gotta...
I will say it is bad form that on the Skype call we can't see your face. You gotta be willing to display something for your audience.
We gotta stop making like pornographic references on these recordings. I'm just saying.
It'll be post credits. We'll be fine. Like, yeah, you're the one that tried to have us do a porn topic.
Yeah, exactly. That's my point. Like, if we're gonna be, like, fucking not allow me to have sex comedy, we may not. We should reference actual pornography.
You made the reference. You made it. We all did. Okay.
What the fuck is happening right
Don't,
now?
All right, listen,
we're
Chowder,
devolving into a debate over the semantics of how we address porn in this podcast.
Yes, it's not semantics. It's fucking comedy. Two, I'm going to get started, okay?
That's fucked up.